Welcome to Double or Nothing. Michael Frazis, you're in San Fran, I think, and you are looking fresh, you're tan, you're looking fit. I've got a new mic here, so I think hopefully all the sound issues are improved and listeners' feedback has been heard. What are you up to?
Well, thanks for that. Good to see you too. They must have put like an AI filter on this. The last couple of weeks, it's been a fascinating time to be here. So there was a Morgan Stanley conference, which had all these kinds of executives from Elon Musk, Bob Iger, all the different software companies. That went for 4 days. And then I kind of stuck around. And on the weekend, as everybody's aware, Silicon Valley Bank and two others, you know, around the same time kind of went bust. So it's been a wild time to be in this part of the world, but it's been great to kind of see it and speak to people who are kind of fortunately more directly involved than we are. Like, we obviously have no direct exposure to those kinds of things. So it's nice to be more of a spectator than anything else.
Awesome. And so how, by the way, I'm commenting on how great you look, because I feel like absolute dogs, you know. I've got, like, I'm tired, I've got three kids, so I'm working, whereas you're looking, you know, you're like mingling with all the hot shots in San Fran. How useful has the conference been? How, like, who are you meeting? What's the goss? Obviously, Silicon Valley has been kind of, you know, I imagine AI is kind of chat running hot. What's the goss?
Look, it's interesting. I'd say it's been more interesting to speak to employees of companies, which is just like friends and friends of friends, and investors. So the CEOs generally gave pretty kind of, I don't know if political is the right word, but very measured, you know, thoughts. And reading between the lines, I'd say that, or not even reading between the lines, I'd say the mood was still pretty bleak from the executives. So a lot of them announced pretty serious growth slowdowns. There's like growth companies that aren't growing now. And it's very clear that the small growth companies are generally continuing to print huge amounts of stock and are all seeing things in those kinds of terms. And it's still striking to see many very mature companies, some of them like 10 years old, who've never made money, who are still printing money. Stock prices are down. And the CEOs seem kind of happy as Larry, like, all considering. But I'd say, interestingly, the big tech CEOs seem much more focused on that, and like cost was a huge thing that everyone was seeming to talk about. So whether it was Google, Facebook, Amazon, you know, there will be continued job cuts, and that kind of bodes ill for the whole sector, because every time somebody, you know, gets fired or laid off from one of these companies, you lose a Windows Office account. It's probably a Salesforce login, probably 20 or 30 different, you know, software platforms churn. And so we're definitely seeing that part of the cycle where seats are kind of like going. And then from the employees, I mean, it's amazing, A, how much people are being paid here and how good things were. But there's kind of, just speaking to a few people that work at big firms, there's a wide acknowledgement that way too many people are hired. And everyone's kind of broadly in support of kind of trimming things down, even though obviously nobody wants to be affected themselves. From the investors, everybody I spoke to was super negative. And so obviously when you go to these conferences and everybody's thinking one thing, generally the opposite happens. But at the same time, it's all I can say is that everybody was looking for shorts. Everybody's very pessimistic. That's kind of the
So why? Yeah. Let's dive into that. Why are investors so negative?
Look, I think it's hard because companies are just continually cutting their growth forecasts. So if you took an optimistic view on basically anything in the last year, things didn't work out particularly well. Like, it's very hard to think of anything that, you know, went up in the growth space, with very few notable exceptions, namely things like big pharma. And then you have the reality that the Fed is still tightening, and, you know, there's that idea that they'll tighten until something breaks. It became such a pervasive idea that Powell actually went out and said that's not what they do. And in fact, it's kind of right, because they did break quite a few things in the last week, and that those breaks are still ongoing. And it looks like as of today, they're still going to raise rates next week. And it's crazy when you think about, you know, like how radical the policy was, the easing policy was, how extended it was, and now how radical this tightening is. Certainly in our lifetimes, we've never seen banks go under and central banks raise rates into it. And if you think about the cause of this, like there's two causes. Obviously, there's like Silicon Valley Bank issues, but there's just this cold, hard numerical reality that you can get, you know, a week ago, you could get 5% in short-term deposits. And banks who've lent out money over the last few years can only afford to pay, you know, between 0 and 2. And so the direct consequence of lifting those government, short-term government rates has been to suck money, this huge money flow that way. And so the Fed's come in and the regulators have come in and basically guaranteed Silicon Valley deposits. But that's not really, that's not the core of the issue. The core of the issue is there's this huge incentive to move your money elsewhere. And it's not a tech thing now. It's, you know, it's the regional banks saw huge outflows. And it might not even be a short-term thing either. Like if you think about it, if you're a treasurer, there's like two things that will be top of mind. Firstly, regardless of guarantees, you cannot have money in a bank that goes under. That just makes you look really stupid. That's huge career risk. And, you know, if you're a father or a mother, if you had responsibility for people and you have cash in a bank, who cares if it's guaranteed? You know, you don't want to go through that weekend of panic and horror. You want to put it somewhere safe. Regardless of guarantees, that's still going to be the case. And then you've also got the reality that you can just get so much more money in basically a much safer asset, which means that that flow of deposits is almost certainly going to be continuing. It might even be a structural thing. And it just comes down to the radicalness of the policy. Like it's very rare for short-term rates to be so much higher than long-term rates. And it causes all kinds of weird things. It massively incentivizes short-term investment over long-term, which also plays havoc with long-term investment portfolios. And it also causes banks to like restrict credit in a massive way.
But I guess the argument is that this is all by design, right? So the whole point of raising interest rates is to kind of go risk off, kind of, you know, a flight to safety, you know, deposits over, you know, savings over, you know, investment at the margins. You know, so you know, it's kind of working as intended. You know, presumably, you know, slowing inflation, all that.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, but it does make you wonder, like, what? I'd say there were two mistakes that were made. Firstly, the radical easing when it was very clear that everything was okay. You know, you could argue from the vaccine they could have like kind of halted things, halted some of the stimulus, but really, you know, kind of in 2021 and late 2021, that was really largely unnecessary, but it was still kind of politically incorrect to say things were going okay. And that lasted, you know, all the way to the end of 2021, basically. But throughout that period, there were plenty of people, you can see the numbers, you can see the prices falling in real time, whether it's rents or commodity prices, you can see it happening in real time and people did. I certainly was not in that bucket. It wasn't something I was paying a huge amount of attention for, too, sadly. But you could see the prices were rising pretty rapidly long before it came in the official statistics. You know, it was kind of like early 2022 that it really started to pick up in the official statistics, even though the live data was happening in like mid-21. Now you've got the same thing. You know, for months you've seen inflation collapse. And, you know, I put a little presentation together. It's like, we know it's going to stay high. It's going to stay high for a few months. It's like no surprise that the number this morning or this evening, this evening, your time was high. But 70% of that was rents, which we know are going down. You can see, and we also know a number of other, if you strip the rents out, which you've been saying for a while, inflation's actually pretty low. And these are the big months last year that will be rolling out, which means that you could be in a situation, but this, as far as you can tell, certainly publicly, Fed rarely acknowledges these kinds of things and really reacts to that political number. Like, what are the papers going to report? They're going to report 6% or 5% or 8% or 0% when inflation was already running rampant. You know, 2%. You know, it's they're really focused on that one number, and that's what's probably led to the first policy mistake, and it's probably what led to or may well become a second policy mistake, which means that Powell will be in wanting to be Volcker and quoting Volcker and saying Volcker-esque things. We'll end up making like the two ultimate central banker mistakes in the space of 2 years, like radical easing too far and then radical tightening too far. But it remains to be seen. Hmm. I mean, who knows? That's my take. Do you have any views on these kinds of things?
So I'm always cautious. Like, I mean, I think there are a whole bunch of narratives where you can say, you know, the Fed's been, you know, structurally making enormous mistakes. And then on the other hand, I'm like, you know, like there are as many opinions on macro as people with opinions, and it's a bit of a dark art, and kind of, you know, I've got a very low confidence views in this area. But kind of moving away from kind of macro, you know, what else are you seeing? Either, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of pessimism, more cuts to come, you know, operational slowdown as these kind of things become self-reinforcing. So that all makes sense. What kind of, you know, either technological or, you know, reasons for optimism or, you know, what else are you kind of hearing on the ground?
Well, we've talked about AI a lot, and I can assure you at this conference, every CEO talked about it, even somewhat superficially. Look, I feel like we're in a new phase here. It's kind of like you've now got banks going bust and weekend rescues. This was kind of two-thirds of the way into the GFC, say. Most of the optimism remains around AI. So I caught up with a friend at a cafe, and he said, like, you know, 2 years ago, this cafe was full of people doing deals, crypto deals, like VC people. Cafe was empty. Anybody that's kind of jumped into some of those areas is probably deeply regretting it now. We can safely say that basically none of those crypto ventures really worked out. And none of the people who jumped from good paying jobs to those jobs can, firstly, probably didn't work out. Secondly, it's not super easy to jump back into Amazon or Google now. But there is that optimism around AI. You know, there is this crazy new technology that has come out. I'm sure you saw that GPT-4 was released today, and that's like means that already it's basically beating, it can pass the bar exam extremely high. It can do Olympiad problems, which GPT-3 couldn't. They've extended it. So if you ever ran out of space, it's much bigger now. And we're still kind of like in the earliest of innings. We're still like almost in beta. Like this product was only released, the original product was only released, you know, half a year ago. There's still optimism around that. And there's also pretty clear that a lot of people are going to be starting their own things. So this is going to release a ton of talent, a ton of people into the broader ecosystem who will end up finding interesting and most likely valuable things to do. And there still seems to be appetite across the board for those exciting early stage ventures. It's just like the troubled ventures and potentially troubled stocks. There's very little appetite for that kind of thing at the moment. Does that make any sense? Everyone's still excited to invest in the right things. But it's earliest. It's almost like early stage is still vibrant. But it's a bit of a hangover for everybody that's raised money in a previous time. I mean, we discussed this kind of.
There's a lot to wash through the system. Like, I think there are a lot of funds raised over the last few years that, you know, without a home to deploy, you know, both kind of empirically and kind of anecdotally, you know, a lot of outside the top quartile funds and investors. You know, most of them will dust their cash basically. And so it's very, you know, that takes a while to kind of wash out of the system. So, you know, everyone's kind of pulled back. And, you know, objectively now is going to be a great time to invest. There's probably less noise. Pricing is less competitive. But at the same time, there's just only so many really excellent opportunities. I think these things just take a long time to kind of wash through the cycle, and ultimately it'll probably be for the better.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem the worst case scenario basically happened where it did turn into full 2000 to 2002 thing. I remember we've talked about whether it was more like that or more one of these kind of shorter things. But if that analog holds, then you're kind of like exiting 2001 or late 2001, early 2002 now. And if you look at things like the bond market, you see that. So actually, they're kind of cutting rates the whole way through. But in the GFC, they're raising rates all the way up through 2008, incredibly. Like, it's bizarre when you see that. You think that because you think of 2008 as a period of like cutting rates and stimulus, but it wasn't. There was lots of tightening going on, commodity prices ripping. I reckon there's a good chance that phase has ended, even if there's a rate rise now. Like, they just can't, the Fed can't pretend that they're not causing damage. And the rate rises they have done recently have not taken effect yet, or have not filtered through the system. You know, there's a well-studied delay in these things, and there's likely to be another one next week. So you've got all that tightening coming through at the same time as, you know, low inflation. The leading unemployment figures are now spiking up for the first time. So that hasn't been a feature so far. And again, it's not in the official data. That's all looking great. But the stuff that kind of generally leads, again, all this data is out there. So it's not hidden. It's just not in these official delayed statistics. But the positive side is you're kind of getting close to the end. Like, that's the final phase would be, they say, like, you buy when central bankers panic. And we're getting close, we're finally getting close to that point. You know, you've certainly got regulators panicking. You've certainly got people rewriting rules and developing new facilities. So basically, obviously, you'd be aware that one of the effects of these higher rates has been that, like, the values of bonds have just collapsed. Basically, any long-term debt, firstly the government debt and any debt that's kind of priced off that. So if you've got a 10-year loan or a 10-year bond or a 10-year government bond, that could be down 20-30%. And that's left this huge gaping hole in people's balance sheets. And it's not quite clear where that's gone. It's like an analog to the GFC in the US, where you knew house prices had fallen by whatever it was, 40%. So you knew there were X trillion dollars of losses, but nobody really knew where they sit, other than that we knew that 1 + 1 = 2, and it is sitting somewhere. It's kind of like that with bond losses. Like, you know that there's been this huge capital hit, but where is it? Like, you're not seeing huge write-downs. You saw in the UK. So the UK, the pension funds did something similar to what Silicon Valley Bank is, which was assumed they could just have these things at par, hold them to maturity. But then if they needed the money, they then had to realize the loss. There's no way around that. The UK regulators panicked, and that actually formed like a low, and then things rallied after that. This has been kind of like the first sign of that here. So create a new facility that you can actually put bonds with the Treasury, US Treasury, and get a par value back, which should relieve things in the short term. But yeah, the good sign of this is you're definitely getting, like, we're quite deep into this now, and this is like a new phase. And you could definitely see a world where the data that's coming through the system kind of deteriorates, and then you get these big moves like we saw in the past few days sustained. So the 2-year dropped, I saw somebody was comparing it to 1987. That was the biggest drop. You know, 1987 was kind of within months of a major decade low. Things basically rallied after, you know, a few months of instability. Things rallied all the way up to 2000. Similarly, like the 210 spread, so that's the one that was inverted, which causes havoc and basically is like a shorthand for incentivizing short term over long term. So that nearly got to 100 basis points. And then it closed, I think it closed 40 or 50 basis, tightened 40 or 50 basis points in a very short period of time, basically throughout that Silicon Valley debacle. And actually, the scary part is that usually it's the steepening that indicates a recession. So everyone talks about yield curve inversion indicating a recession is coming, but the actual onset of recession is generally comes shortly after the yield curve steepens. Basically, as money just pours into short-term debt at the expense of everything else. And I guess we saw that over the last two days for the first time, like a massive steepening. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens. But, you know, surprisingly, the other thing that was kind of positive is those tech was pretty well supported. Obviously, I follow this very closely, and particularly big tech and chip makers have been massively outperforming lately. And that kind of makes sense. You know, these are companies that are cash flow positive, making money, buying back stock, and exposed to this one hyper growth area at the moment, which is AI. There's plenty to be optimistic about. I think you're just gonna have to be really careful to be in those. And it's clear that the companies like there's one that reported last night, GitLab, which just dropped 30%. You know, they increased their stock comp for the quarter from 8 to 30 while guiding down, still growing, but guiding down significantly. It's like, well, if you're going to issue 30 million extra, if you're going to, like, basically in this case, more than triple your stock-based comp, market's going to mark you down 30%. at least. So that part of the market is like still really challenged, and these are still incredibly expensive companies. So I'll finish the wrap, but I'll give one. So like Datadog is like a $20 billion company with like one over $20 billion with $1.5 billion of revenue today. And they guided to basically flat sequential growth. So they're not going to grow quarter on quarter. So you've got a company trading at a very hefty sales multiple, probably in, well in excess of many actually growing companies' after-tax earnings multiple. And so that part of the market seems really challenged still.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say to kind of bring that back to Australia. Obviously, we look at a lot of software businesses here. I'd say we're on balance, not much has changed from a macro perspective. I'd say we're on balance still positive around investing now, and that things, we're obviously not the kind of highest growth part of the market, but still have a positive structural view of tailwinds over like the next 3 to 5 years, albeit obviously does vary sector by sector and is kind of company specific. But and I'd say, we obviously, well, we yesterday, the acquisition of Nitro, we kind of got over 50%, which is neat, in terms of acceptances and into the takeover. A few others are still on the boil, and I'd say that this still seems to be a lot of kind of public markets activity. So where public markets are on balance negative, private investors who can kind of take a longer term view and kind of change the trajectory of these companies in private markets seem to remain relatively bullish. So I don't know, I kind of get you're kind of a bit gloomy from a public markets perspective, and I kind of get why. And you're kind of in the thick of it, and with the whole Silicon Valley Bank collapse in San Fran and stuff. But from our perspective, not much has changed probably over the last little while, and we're still bullish about investing here over the
You
medium
notice
term.
in portfolio companies or in companies you speak to, have you noticed like a slowdown in growth or increase in churn? Is that like something that's happening in the parts of the Australian market that you're looking at?
Not more than we've seen over the last 6 to 12 months. I think when we first bid for Nitro, we were looking at all the noise that was coming out of the US in terms of DocuSign and Adobe. And I guess a lot of the commentary then, which is similar to the commentary now, is that this kind of ongoing operational slowdown, it's harder to make the marginal sale, as the low-hanging fruit's been kind of picked, and you've kind of got big bloated sales teams. And so it's just tough. I'd say that's like, that hasn't really changed. Like, I just don't think, like, we're still kind of in that part of the cycle that's kind of working its way through. But to be honest, like, you see, every kind of operational chart you look at has this big spike in metrics over COVID. And then to be honest, it's kind of just reverting. That's the kind of very high level, overwhelming perspective. I it's not obvious. I think, it's fair to bake in, everyone in Australia is kind of expecting, a real recession, at least a per capita recession. Maybe with immigration, we'll kind of have a, only, we'll kind of miss, we'll have continued GDP growth, albeit we might have a per capita recession. In nominal terms, obviously, we probably won't have a recession because of inflation. So I don't know, like, it depends where your business is and what it's leveraged to, whether that's kind of good or bad. But to be honest, overall, our portfolio in particular is kind of going well and continuing to grow well. That's not super representative. I mean, when we kind of look out there though, we're not seeing an obvious, obvious operational challenges versus like 6 months ago.
Interesting. And do you have an opinion on the, just to change topic a little bit, on Australia's submarine deal that they just announced?
You know, I haven't really paid attention. Like my biggest kind of insight into this, you know, I read How to Defend Australia by Hugh White, which is a really excellent book. If you're Australian, non-Australian, it is just a beautiful book because Hugh White's probably the preeminent defense academic in the country, but he doesn't write like an academic. It's not dense and full of verbiage and kind of, it's so readable and such a pleasure to read and so thoughtful. And his basic thesis, you know, is that we just need way more submarines. Like, why on earth do we need tanks? And a lot of it's just around, you know, capture, you know, like the army basically has captured a portion of revenue and kind of keeps feeding itself, but really we just need a bunch of submarines. Now, you know, we probably need lots of submarines, probably need to be off the shelf. You know, or if we're building enough of them, you know, maybe we can have a local industry. You know, so, you know, with respect to this, you're buying a few nuclear subs. You know, I don't know, like the nuclear thing seems to be a fair fee. Like, I think everyone just kind of conflates it with having nuclear capabilities, but really it's just the power mechanism. And it's not obvious we need that. It's just way more expensive, basically. Like, so, you know, I think it's good that they're kind of off the shelf. You know, are these the ones we need? I don't really know enough or have a strong view. I'd be very keen to see what kind of Hugh White says. I think he's like super sensible and kind of a little bit orthogonal to the defense establishment. That kind of sidelines him a little bit. So I don't have a super, super strong view. These decisions though, like they're never made with like, what is Australia's optimal defence strategy? They're probably the kind of cascade of priorities is, you know, one, what does the US want us to do? Because we're effectively, you know, a forward operating base for the US empire, which is fine. That's like a reality and, you know, we're safe under its umbrella generally and whatever. And then like two, you know, what are the political implications around, you know, where does the money flow and the jobs go and the like? And then three, it's like, you know, defense optimization and who's kind of fighting for what. And I should say probably before that, it's probably like what stakeholders within the army and navy are winning versus losing and who's kind of more muscular at a given time. So like in terms of optimal defense strategy, that's like priority like four or five, you know, priority one to three or something are like, you know, political considerations, whether it's internal stakeholders, Australian electorate, or kind of US defense bosses. So it's super opaque, the decision-making here. And I have whatever the outcome is, I'd have very little confidence that it maps well onto like our best hope is that it maps partially onto our optimal defense pathways.
There's some value. I guess if you're a fan of, I guess that means Australia will have some kind of nuclear industry and expertise. Maybe that helps promote kind of a nuclear energy.
Who knows? It's always the details. You know, is it in engineering? Is it in like, you know, it could be super niche and small. You know, these things are just hard without the requisite scale, to be honest. It all comes down to detail. I don't really know what the detail here is. Like if it's off the shelf, it could just literally be maintained offshore or something. You know, we'll have to see.
It's like we found this like limitless source of energy, harnessing basically the power of the sun. And we've all decided as a society not to use it, but we will use it on these like deathly underwater machines. It's like the whole world.
It's super random. Like these things are super random. Yeah.
Submarines. Yeah. It's bizarre. I think it's $368 billion. Like, I imagine it's going to end up being a lot more, but that's a lot of money. That's for Australia. Like, what's our
economy? Oh, it's a disaster.
I mean,
it's very expensive.
Yeah, compared that to other things, I guess. But I guess defense spending always looks ridiculous compared to other things. Like, the numbers are always just huge on a national scale. But, yeah. You know, how many drones does that get you?
Awesome. Nice. Well, enjoy the rest of your trip. Hopefully you get some rest. You're looking well, and we'll chat when you're back.
Sounds good. We'll speak soon.